Welcome to the Deep Dive. This week, October 5th to the 12th, it feels like the global financial world is really trying to navigate through, well, a perfect storm of conflicting signals.
Yeah, it's quite the setup. You've got these high-stakes geopolitical events bubbling away, constantly impacting energy prices and, you know, those safe haven assets.
Right. And then you layer on top of that absolutely critical messages coming from central banks across, what, three different continents, defining where global rates might be heading.
And the kicker, the real defining feature, a complete gaping hole right where the U.S. economic data should be, thanks to the ongoing federal government shutdown.
It's that vacuum, isn't it?
Yeah.
Our sources are basically saying we're flying blind on some really fundamental stuff. Labor numbers, agricultural stat.
Completely. Key reports that markets rely on week in, week out. Things like weekly jobless claims, suspended, that crucial USDA WASDA report for agriculture, postponed indefinitely. It's a big deal.
Okay, so that's our mission for this deep dive then. We need to walk through this, well, chaotic and frankly, information-starved week, pretty much chronologically, across currencies, commodities, equities.
And figure out what scraps of information the market did manage to cling on to. And maybe more importantly, how are these ongoing geopolitical risks actually shaping economic decisions when the usual U.S. data narrative is just silent?
The tension there is huge. Because when the U.S. engine room goes quiet like this, the rest of the world, the global market, it's forced to lean so much more heavily on what other central banks are saying, right?
Exactly. Rhetoric from the ECB, the Bank of England, the RBNZ, and those very few private sector data points like consumer sentiment surveys, it fundamentally shifts how global rates get priced.
And probably ramps up volatility on every single non-U.S. announcement, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. Every piece of non-U.S. news just gets amplified.
All right, let's kick things off on Sunday, October 5th. The week started with that high-stakes OPEC Plus ministerial meeting. Always puts energy markets on edge. Given how tight supply is, what was the outcome there?
Well, the decision was pretty widely anticipated, actually. And in the end, it seemed designed more for stability than for, you know, delivering a shock. The OPEC Plus group, that's the big coalition, including Saudi Arabia and Russia, they agreed to a fairly modest output increase.
Modest? How modest are we talking?
About 137,000 barrels per day. It's a gradual increase scheduled to start in November.
137,000 barrels. That sounds almost like a rounding error compared to global demand, right? Was that split evenly? Who's doing the lifting?
Not quite evenly, no. The two heavyweights, Saudi Arabia and Russia, they're contributing the bulk of it. Each agreed to add about 42,000 barrels per day to that total increase.
Okay, so still relatively small numbers from the big players.
Exactly. And that modesty is key. It was probably smaller than some members might have wanted, which helps ease those immediate fears of, you know, suddenly flooding the market. It provides some ongoing support for Brent crude futures. Signals discipline, really.
And if we put our geopolitical lens on, especially thinking about Russia and the war in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. How does this small increase fit with Moscow's financial needs right now? They need high oil prices, surely.
That's a fascinating angle. Oil prices have become absolutely critical for Russia's war financing. Our sources indicate the enormous cost of the conflict has really pushed up Russia's fiscal break-even oil price, the price they need just to balance the state budget.
So they have a massive incentive to keep prices high.
An existential incentive, yeah. So their agreement to just a modest increase, continuing this very slow unwinding of the earlier production cuts, it represents a kind of internal compromise, maybe. They keep prices supportive enough to fund the military, but offer just enough of an increase to maintain stability within the OPEC Plus group, you know, keep other members reasonably happy. It's a very delicate balancing act for them, purely focused on maximizing oil revenue.
And while OPEC Plus is making these calculations, back in the U.S., the federal government shutdown is in full swing. Beyond just delaying data, what are the sort of immediate systemic risks that creates, especially around critical infrastructure?
Yeah, the shutdown, which kicked off October 1st, it creates this systemic vulnerability. And the timing couldn't be worse, ironically, because October is actually Cybersecurity Awareness Month.
Oh, the irony.
Right. But with CISA, that's the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, operating at reduced capacity and specific funding cuts happening, the nation's digital defenses are just weaker. We saw, for instance, the direct termination of about $27 million in annual federal funding for something called the MSISAC.
Okay, MSISAC. Let's unpack that acronym. What is it, and why is cutting its funding such a problem right now?
The MSISAC, it stands for the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center. It's absolutely vital. It provides free, essential cyber threat intelligence, incident response help, and other cybersecurity services specifically for state, local, tribal, and territorial governments.
Ah, so the smaller government bodies that often don't have huge cybersecurity budgets themselves.
Precisely. They often lack the resources for really sophisticated defenses. So cutting MSIS's funding during a shutdown, it dramatically increases the vulnerability of essential local services. Think power grids, hospital networks, city transport systems, water facilities. They become much easier targets for potential state-sponsored cyber attacks or ransomware groups. The very systems meant to protect the public are running on fumes.
Wow. Okay. Shifting gears slightly, yeah, but staying with high-stakes situations, Sunday also saw those ongoing, very sensitive Middle East diplomatic efforts. The indirect ceasefire talks between Israel and Hamas, hosted by Egypt and Cairo. What was the status as the week began?
Sources confirmed that initial delicate talks focused on potential hostage releases were actively underway. There was even mention of using Trump's 20-point Gaza plan as a kind of working framework. Hamas had apparently responded positively to an earlier ceasefire proposal.
But there's always a but in these situations, isn't there?
There usually is. The path to a formal, lasting ceasefire looked, well, deeply obstructed. Opposition from far-right political factions within Israel meant a formal deal wasn't confirmed. So unfortunately, the short-term outlook was still for the conflict to likely continue, even though those diplomatic channels remained open.
And how quickly do markets react to news flow out of Cairo? How sensitive are they to progress versus setbacks?
Oh, the sensitivity is immediate and quite high. It mainly plays out through oil prices and safe haven assets. Any sign of real progress, maybe a confirmed prisoner exchange, a humanitarian pause that could instantly take some air out of oil prices, removing that regional war risk premium.
On the flip side?
Setbacks or worse, escalation. That tends to give a boost to traditional safe havens. Look at gold. It was trading near its all-time highs, hovering around, what, $3,886 to $3,900 an ounce?
Yeah, really elevated.
And that sustained high price is a direct reflection of all this geopolitical uncertainty. Middle East, Eastern Europe, plus it's reinforced by huge central bank buying. Forecasts suggest central banks might snap up around 1,000 tons of gold globally in 2025. So, yeah, uncertainty fuels that ultimate safety trade.
Okay, let's move into Monday. The focus shifts a bit towards Europe and Asia. Japan kicked off the week, appointing a new prime minister, Sanae Takaichi, from the LDP. Does that signal a big policy shift or more like continuity for the world's third largest economy?
That was seen as a very clear signal of continuity and stability, which is frankly what global markets prefer from Japan. Takaichi is expected to pretty much follow the policy line of her predecessor.
So sticking with the sort of Abenomics playbook, ultra-loose fiscal and monetary policy.
Essentially, yes. That continuity supports Japanese stock valuations and, crucially for currency markets, it helps maintain JPY stability. Avoids any unwelcome surprises from Tokyo.
Meanwhile, over in the Eurozone, we got retail sales data for September. Given all the talk about Europe's economy slowing down, what did that number suggest about the European consumer? Were they still spending?
The expectation was pretty muted, actually. Something like a plus 0.2% rise month over month and plus 1.0% year over year. Look, it wasn't expected to be spectacular, but any positive consumer spending number provides some, you know, small bit of support for the euro and maybe European stocks.
Because the Eurozone is trying hard to prove it can avoid a deep recession.
Desperately. So these data points are watched closely, but the consensus really suggested consumers were still feeling pretty constrained by that lingering inflation and, of course, high energy costs.
We also had a fair bit of central bank chatter on Monday. Both ECB President Lagarde and Bank of England Governor Bailey were speaking. What was the main message the market was trying to pull from Europe's top bankers?
Markets were definitely on the hunt for any hints, even subtle ones, of future policy easing coming out of Europe. That would really sharpen the contrast with the Fed's expected stance, which, even without data, was presumed to be tighter, or at least on hold for longer.
So what did Lagarde say?
Lagarde's comments, speaking at the European Parliament, were predictably cautious. She stuck to that policy on hold script, stressing the commitment to the 2% inflation target, but also, importantly, explicitly acknowledging the slower growth environment across the Eurozone.
And Governor Bailey from the Bank of England, similar cautious tone.
Very much so. Bailey, speaking over in Zurich, really hammered home the tough balancing act the UK faces trying to tame that really persistent high inflation without tipping the economy into a deep recession. So the key takeaway from both was policy patience. Hold steady for now.
Does any strong emphasis on those downside growth risks from Europe? Does that reinforce the idea of policy divergence between Europe and the U.S., especially when the Fed is thought to be more focused on inflation?
Absolutely. That divergence narrative usually strengthens the U.S. dollar. If Europe sounds worried about growth, while the Fed sounds, or is presumed to sound, worried about inflation, money tends to flow towards the higher-yielding currency, which has been the dollar.
Quick question, though. Given that U.S. data vacuum we keep mentioning, does the market end up putting more weight on these non-U.S. central bank comments? Simply because there's nothing new coming out of Washington to counter them.
That's a great point. Yes, I think it does. Without fresh, reliable U.S. data, the market can't properly price in the risk of a U.S. slowdown. So commentary from the ECB, the BOE, or, as we'll see later, the RBNZ, discussing their domestic growth risks, it gains disproportionate weight. Traders almost latch onto these foreign growth concerns as a sort of proxy for potential global weakness, amplifying that policy divergence signal.
Okay, let's pivot now pretty sharply over to the Asia-Pacific region. Tuesday brought several key central bank decisions, starting with the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. A rate cut was widely expected there, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. The RBNZ was under intense scrutiny. Consensus was very strong for them to cut their official cash rate, the OCR, by 25 basis points. That would bring it down to 2.75%.
And the rationale behind that?
Pretty clear signals of slowing inflation in New Zealand and definitely a cooling housing market, maybe even contracting slightly. New Zealand, like some other smaller open economies, seems to be signaling, okay, our tightening cycle is done. We can now afford to ease the pressure a bit.
Was that 25 basis point cut fully baked into market prices already, or was there still sensitivity around what the RBNZ might say?
Oh, the market was still highly sensitive, especially to any dovish surprises. While 25 basis points was the base case, there was some chatter among analysts about a more aggressive, maybe 50 basis point cut.
Right, a bigger move. What would that have signaled?
If they'd gone for 50 points, or if their statement alongside the cut had really aggressively pointed towards more easing down the road, you would have seen a sharp, immediate weakening of the New Zealand dollar, the NZD. A 50 BP cut would signal they're genuinely worried about the economy, maybe even bordering on panic, and that would trigger a significant repricing in NZ bonds.
So the RBNZ decision was a really clear example this week of a central bank decisively moving away from that tight inflation-fighting stance we still sort of expect from the Fed, even without the data.
Exactly. A clear divergence in action.
And New Zealand wasn't the only one easing policy in the region on Tuesday.
Correct. The Bank of Thailand was also expected to deliver a modest cut, 0.25%, bringing their main rate down to 2.25%. Again, mostly driven by slowing domestic inflation pressures there. Seems to be a bit of a regional trend, moving towards lower rates.
Okay, let's turn to Japan. Later on Tuesday evening, U.S. time, we heard from the Bank of Japan Governor Kazuo Ueda. Given the constant global speculation about when or if the BOJ will finally exit its ultra-loose policy, what was the market looking for from him?
Ueda was speaking at a significant financial forum, and honestly, the base case expectation was for a completely status quo message, you know, reiterating the need for a gradual policy normalization.
Emphasizing that the conditions aren't quite right yet.
Precisely. Saying that the kind of underlying durable inflation needed to confidently hit their 2% target still isn't firmly entrenched. Now, he might throw in some verbal warnings about yen volatility. That's a classic BOJ move to try and talk the currency up without actually doing anything.
Oh, tailboning.
Exactly. But the market was really braced for continuity. Any unexpected hawkish comments like hinting at speeding up rate hikes or ditching negative interest rate policy sooner than expected, that would have been a major shock. It would have sent the yen soaring and caused a huge spike in Japanese government bond yields, JGBs, sending ripples globally. But it was seen as unlikely.
Shifting from central banks to corporate signals now. Tuesday also brought a potentially crucial read on global manufacturing health via Samsung Electronics. They released their preliminary Q3 earnings guidance. Why is Samsung's performance considered such an important proxy for global traders?
Samsung is just massive. It's a true bellwether, especially for the whole global technology cycle. And the expectation was for them to guide towards a really strong quarter. Operating profit maybe around 10 trillion won. That's a huge jump, over 20% year over year.
Wow. What's driving that kind of rebound?
It seems to be almost entirely driven by that long-awaited upturn in the memory chip market, plus probably some successful cost-cutting internally as well.
So this isn't just about one company's profits, is it? It's seen as an indicator for the entire tech supply chain.
Exactly right. Strong guidance from Samsung is a major positive signal for the whole global chip sector. Think the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index, the SOX. It suggests that improving global tech demand is finally starting to filter through the system.
And in a week like this, starved of U.S. macro data, does a corporate report like Samsung's take on even more significance?
I think it does. It suddenly feels almost like a macro signal in itself. It hints that maybe the hard-hit global manufacturing sector is finally starting to turn a corner. That provides a bit of a positive impulse for global growth expectations, interestingly contrasting with those dovish central bank cuts we just talked about in the APAC region.
Outside of tech, Europe's industrial powerhouse, Germany, also gave us some fresh data. What did we learn about the health of the Eurozone's manufacturing core?
Germany released its August industrial production figures. The expectation was for a slight tick up, maybe 0.5% month over month. And then later in the week, their balance of trade data was expected to show a pretty healthy surplus, around 16.1 billion euros.
So signs of resilience despite the headwinds.
That was the hope reflected in the consensus numbers, yeah. These are key checks on European industry, which has definitely been battered by high energy costs and weaker global demand. So any signs of resilience would be supportive for the euro.
And looking across the Atlantic, but north of the border, we also got a read on North American manufacturing from Canada.
Right. Canada's IV PMI, the Purchasing Managers Index for September. The expectation was for it to land just a fraction above that 50 mark, maybe 50.1. Anything above 50 signals expansion, so even just barely crossing that threshold, would be seen as positive for manufacturing strength. And that report directly influences the Canadian dollar, the CAD, because Canada's economy is so closely tied to manufacturing and commodity exports.
Okay, let's swing back to the U.S. debt market. Tuesday also brought the first big test of U.S. Treasury demand for the week, the three-year note auction. Why is the front end of the yield curve, the short end, so significant right now?
That three-year option for about $58 billion, it's really crucial for testing investor appetite right at the front end of the curve. This part of the curve is super sensitive to where the market thinks the Fed's short-term policy rate is headed.
Who typically buys these shorter-term notes?
You often see money market funds, short-term international sovereign buyers. Folks attracted by the relatively high yield, which was expected to be around 4.8% for this auction.
So if this auction goes smoothly, what does that signal compared to, say, the 10-year or 30-year auctions later in the week?
A smooth three-year auction, meaning strong demand, a good bid-to-cover ratio, generally helps market sentiment. It suggests investors feel short-term rates are attractive, maybe likely to stay high for a bit, but perhaps not going to spiral uncontrollably higher. It shows confidence in the front end.
And if it went poorly?
A poor auction, weak demand, that would immediately push those front-end yields higher. It creates anxiety that maybe the market is starting to struggle to absorb the sheer volume of debt the Treasury needs to issue. So it's a key sentiment check early in the week.
And finally, just touching on Wednesday morning, we saw China's markets come back online.
Right. China's financial markets fully reopen after their Golden Week holiday. Traditionally, that return injects a significant amount of liquidity back into global markets. And if the holiday spending data from China looked positive, it often gives a nice little boost to commodity currencies like the Aussie dollar and industrial metals like copper, given China's huge role as a consumer.
Okay, Wednesday really felt like the pivot point of the week, didn't it? Dominated by these two massive kind of intertwined events. Looking back at policy via the FOMC minutes and then a real-time stress test for global benchmark rates with the 10-year auction. Let's start with what was arguably the highest impact U.S. macro event of the whole week, the release of the FOMC minutes.
Yeah, absolutely critical. These minutes were from the September 16-17 meeting. That's the one where the Fed actually cut rates by 25 basis points. And because the official September U.S. jobs report, the NFP, is likely delayed due to the shutdown, well, these minutes suddenly become the only official detailed window the market gets this week into what the Fed as a collective was thinking about the economy just a few weeks ago.
So traders were going to be dissecting these with a fine-tooth comb, looking for clues about future moves.
Absolutely. Forensic detail. They were primarily focused on, I'd say, three main things. First, how deep was the debate about that September cut? Was it a really close call or was there broad agreement?
Okay, the internal dynamics. What else?
Second, they were looking for any evidence of rising concern among Fed members about the labor market softening and also worries about inflation maybe running persistently below their 2% target. Any signs of that would be seen as dovish.
That's true.
Third, hunting for any discussion around where the committee sees the long-run neutral rate of interest, that sort of theoretical rate that neither stimulates nor restricts the economy. If they start talking about that long-run rate being potentially lower than previously thought, it implies less need for future tightening.
And heading into the release, what was the general expectation about the overall tone of these minutes, especially given the missing jobs data context?
The broad expectation was definitely for the tone to lean dovish. The market was anticipating the minutes might reveal some internal skepticism about that whole higher for longer rates narrative that had been so dominant, and maybe a growing worry about the lagged effects of all the previous tightening potentially pushing the U.S. towards a slowdown.
And the fact that the consensus expectation for the delayed NFP report was pretty soft, maybe only 50,000 jobs added. Did that feed into the expectation for dovish minutes?
Completely. It felt like the minutes were expected to sort of pre-justify the Fed's easing bias, aligning with what the market thought the missing labor data would show.
So if the minutes did confirm that easing bias, how does that typically ripple through markets? Rates, the dollar.
Confirmation of an easing bias tends to reinforce expectations for more Fed cuts down the line, maybe even two more before the end of the year, according to some forecasts back then. That usually pulls short-term Treasury yields down, and consequently, the U.S. dollar index, the DXY, would likely weaken.
Which is generally good for.
Good for risk assets, especially those rate-sensitive tech and growth stocks. They tend to thrive when the market anticipates lower future borrowing costs. Now, the flip side is, if those minutes had come out surprisingly hawkish, really emphasizing persistent inflation risks despite the cut, that would have been a major shock, send yields soaring and stocks tumbling. It's such an interesting tension, though, isn't it? We're interpreting the dovishness from September based on the data the Fed had then, but the market is completely starved of the current October labor data that could either conform or contradict that view.
Yeah, flying blind again. And that whole rates narrative, built partly on these minutes, was immediately put to the test by the second huge U.S. event on Wednesday, the 10-year note auction. This isn't just some domestic affair. This is the global benchmark.
Absolutely. The U.S. Treasury was auctioning around $39 billion in 10-year notes. The yield on this specific bond is basically the foundation for global financing costs. It directly influences mortgage rates, corporate bond yields, even what other countries pay to borrow. It's that important.
Was demand expected to be strong? Where were yields expected to land?
Solid demand was anticipated, yeah. Yields were expected to clear somewhere in that 4.7% to 4.8% range. There was strong expected interest from foreign central banks and big global asset managers looking for yield.
Why does this specific 10-year auction carry such massive global weight, more so than the 3-year or even the 30-year?
Because it's seen as this real-time kind of nonpartisan referendum on global confidence. Confidence in U.S. fiscal management, yes, but also the outlook for long-term inflation and growth globally. A well-received auction meaning strong demand, a high bid-to-cover ratio, a minimal tail between the average and lowest accepted price that helps put a cap on the 10-year Treasury yield. That provides crucial support for stock valuations worldwide.
And a weak auction.
A weak auction. Mm. That pressures Treasuries immediately, forces yields higher, and instantly sparks a repricing of rates globally. It raises borrowing costs everywhere and puts serious pressure on risk assets. It's a major risk event.
Okay, let's quickly jump back across the Atlantic. Wednesday also brought the European counterpart to the FOMC minutes, the ECB accounts from their September meeting.
Right, the ECB account provides similar insight into the thinking over in Frankfurt. Now remember, the ECB actually held rates steady in September, unlike the Fed's cut. So the expectation for these accounts was that they'd likely reveal still persistent inflation worries among the governing council members.
So looking for justification for why they didn't cut.
Exactly. Looking for discussion where governors were arguing about upside risks to prices, which would validate their decision to keep rates at those restrictive levels.
Did the accounts offer any hints about their plans for quantitative tightening, shrinking their balance sheet?
That was something analysts were watching for, too. While the main focus was probably still inflation, some debate about the future pace of QT might have surfaced. The overall consensus view was probably that ECB policy was already sufficiently restrictive. But if those accounts leaned heavily hawkish on inflation sticking around, you know, governors worried about second and third round effects of high prices becoming embedded, then you could see the euro firm up a bit and German bund yields would likely rise.
Which again reinforces that policy divergence narrative we talked about earlier. Fed worried about growth, ECB still may be more worried about inflation.
Precisely. The Fed seemingly looking over its shoulder at a potential slowdown, while the ECB is still very much focused on nailing inflation back down to
All
target.
right, Thursday. This was the day the U.S. government shutdown really felt like it paralyzed the flow of essential market information. Let's just run through the data cancellations first. What key reports were officially confirmed as being suspended or postponed?
The paralysis was pretty systemic by Thursday. The Labor Department confirmed no weekly jobless claims report. That was expected around 220,000 claims. That's our main real-time pulse check on the labor market, just gone.
And the other big one, especially for commodity folks.
Even more critical for commodity markets, yeah. The USDA confirmed that the October 9th WASDA report, the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates, was officially postponed until the government reopened. That report is huge.
Explain just how significant that WASDA delay is. Why is it so crucial?
The WASDA is basically the global Bible for grain and oilseed supply, demand, and price forecasts. Corn, soybeans, wheat. Its absence is like taking the main navigation charts away from a cargo ship captain.
So what happens in the markets?
The direct consequence is that those key agricultural futures markets start trading much more on noise and less reliable signals. Things like short-term weather patterns, private analyst forecasts, which can vary wildly, anecdotal reports from the fields. It significantly ramps up volatility because there's no official anchor, no benchmark for global supply levels. Traders are forced to rely much more on rumor and conjecture.
And the absence of weekly claims and the WASDE delay, that pretty much confirmed the inevitable delay of the biggest potential data point of the week, right? The Friday NFP jobs report.
Exactly. The official U.S. non-farm payrolls report for September, originally scheduled for Friday, was now seen as highly likely to be delayed. And remember, the market consensus before the delay was for a very soft number, maybe only 50,000 net new jobs created.
Which would have been seen as very dovish for the Fed.
Hugely dovish, partly attributed to the ongoing auto strike impact and anecdotal evidence of corporate hiring freezes. So the delay meant that this potentially powerful signal supporting the Fed's easing bias just vanished. The market was forced back to relying solely on interpreting those FOMC minutes from Wednesday.
So, with the market genuinely flying blind on labor strength and agricultural supply, where do traders even turn to get a real-time temperature check on the economy?
They have to turn to corporate health, the actual earnings reports coming out. They become vital economic proxies. And Thursday brought two massive bellwethers, PepsiCo and Delta Airlines. Let's start with Pepsi. What does the performance of a giant consumer staples company like that tell us?
PepsiCo, PEP, it's the quintessential mass market consumer staples giant, right? Consensus was looking for Q3 earnings per share around $2.29 on revenues near $23.9 billion. The results are absolutely vital because they give you a direct signal about the financial resilience of the average consumer and how sensitive they are to ongoing inflation.
What specifically are you looking for in their numbers?
You're watching the balance between volume and price. Is there revenue growth coming from selling more stuff? Or is it mostly coming from just raising prices, what we call pricing power? If they're showing strong pricing power, but the volume of goods sold is flat or declining, that's a really stark signal. It suggests lower and middle-income consumers are feeling squeezed, they're stressed, pulling back on discretionary items, maybe even buying less of the essentials. Okay, so Pepsi gives us the mass market view. And then contrasting that, we had Delta Airlines, DAL, also reporting Q3, the first major airline out of the gate.
Right. Delta provides that crucial other side of the coin. Expected EPS was around 1.53 cents, revenue about $15.9 billion. As the first big airline to report, Delta gives us vital insight into both leisure and, importantly, corporate travel demand, and especially demand for those premium, high-margin seats, first-class, business-class. Their results really set the tone for the whole airline sector and the broader travel industry.
Okay, this is where the analysis gets really interesting, I think. You take Pepsi, representing the mass market consumer, and Delta, representing more of the higher-income experiential consumer, and you put them side by side. It gives you a powerful lens on this K-shaped economic recovery idea, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. It maps that bifurcated or K-shaped economy almost perfectly. If Delta reports strong results, especially in its premium cabins and international routes, it tells you that the upper end of consumer spending is still incredibly resilient. That segment is thriving, traveling, spending.
And Pepsi tells the other side of the story.
Exactly. If Pepsi's results show those strong price increases, but maybe flat or declining volumes, it confirms that lower and middle-income households are facing a real financial squeeze. They're prioritizing necessities, maybe trading down to cheaper brands, cutting back on quantities.
So if both reports confirm those respective trends, Delta strong, Pepsi showing volume strain, that's pretty undeniable corporate evidence of the K-shaped reality.
Undeniable, tangible evidence. And that's critical context for the Fed, even if they can't see the official jobs numbers. It tells a story about the unevenness of the economy.
Now, alongside those corporate health checks, Thursday also brought the final, and maybe most defining, test of long-term debt demand, the 30-year bond auction. Why is the 30-year, the long bond, considered such a definitive test of long-term risk appetite?
This is the big one for the longest end of the yield curve. It's a really critical indicator of demand for long-duration assets. The Treasury was auctioning about $22 billion in 30-year bonds. The yield was expected to be attractive, maybe around 5.0%.
Who buys these really long bonds?
It attracts a specific type of buyer. Big pension funds, insurance companies, other long-horizon institutional investors. They need predictable, guaranteed income streams stretching decades into the future to match their liabilities.
What are the implications if this auction goes really well or really badly?
Okay, a smoothly bid 30-year auction, strong demand that could effectively put a ceiling or at least a temporary cap on long-term yields. That's actually very favorable for the broader financial system. It helps steepen the yield curve, meaning short-term yields are lower than long-term yields, which is generally seen as healthier for banks, good for risk assets, helps the real estate market.
And a weak auction.
A weak auction at the 30-year mark. That would really spoof the bond market. It signals poor long-term investor confidence or maybe just an inability to absorb all the debt being issued. It would send that 30-year yield potentially dramatically higher and put major pressure on anything sensitive to long-term rates, tech stocks again, mortgage-backed securities, things like that.
Okay, moving into Friday. The official U.S. data calendar is basically empty because of the shutdown, right? But there was one major U.S. indicator that did come out as planned.
That's right. The University of Michigan's Preliminary Consumer Sentiment Index for October. Because it's a private survey run by the university, it wasn't affected by the government shutdown. The headline index was expected to be pretty subdued, maybe around 54.6.
Now, in this specific environment, this data vacuum we're in, why does this single sentiment-based report suddenly take on such critical importance for global markets? It's usually important, but this feels different.
It becomes disproportionately important, yeah. Because the official hard data on jobs and prices, at least the latest, are missing, the market is forced to hyper-focus on what consumers think or expect about the future, especially inflation.
So it's the internals of the report that matter most.
Absolutely. The most critical pieces are the 1 year and the 5 to 10 year inflation expectations components. They were previously running around 3.2% for the 1 year and maybe 2.8, 2.9% for the longer term. These expectation numbers feed directly into how the Federal Reserve thinks and reacts.
So what's the risk here?
The risk is this. If, against that backdrop of potentially dovish FOMC minutes from earlier in the week, these consumer inflation expectations suddenly jump higher unexpectedly, that single data point could risk completely overshadowing all the earlier easing signals. It forces the Fed and the market to worry that inflation is becoming psychologically sticky, that people believe it's going to stay high, even if the missing hard data might eventually say otherwise. It's a huge focus.
Okay, beyond the scheduled economic calendar, the whole week was obviously colored by these ongoing high-stakes geopolitical flashpoints that just kept market tension and risk premiums elevated. Let's quickly revisit the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
Yeah, the war grinds on, unfortunately. Over 1,300 days now. And we saw what looked like a significant and strategically worrying shift in Russian targeting this week. Russia launched major large-scale attacks specifically aimed at Ukrainian energy infrastructure.
Hitting power plants, gas facilities.
Exactly. Reports mentioned gas facilities in places like Kharkiv and Poltava regions being hit hard. This looks like a direct attempt to cripple Ukraine's energy system ahead of winter and also potentially disrupt any remaining gas flows towards Europe that might transit through Ukraine.
How do attacks like that pressure European markets and the euro specifically?
They keep the euro-USD currency pair really sensitive to energy price news. These attacks just heighten those energy supply security concerns for Europe all over again, threatening potential spikes in natural gas prices as winter draws closer. And persistently high energy costs in Europe act like a tax on the whole eurozone economy, right? It pressures the euro downwards and makes the European Central Bank's job fighting inflation and avoiding recession even harder.
Okay, shifting focus eastward now. That persistent tension between China and Taiwan seemed to potentially interact with a big diplomatic event happening in Europe this week, the EU's Global Gateway Forum. What was that forum all about?
The Global Gateway Forum, held in Brussels October 9th and 10th, was a major diplomatic push by the EU. The main goal was to promote strategic global investments, positioning Europe as a sort of values-driven alternative to China's massive Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI.
So funding infrastructure projects around the world, but with an EU stamp on them.
Kind of, yeah. The forum put a big emphasis on advancing these high-profile alternative infrastructure plans. The most notable one being discussed was the IMC, the India-Middle East-Europe Corridor, that proposed rail and shipping route.
Right. So how does an infrastructure forum in Brussels possibly create tangible risk in the Taiwan Strait? What's the connection?
From Beijing's perspective, initiatives like the Global Gateway, and especially something concrete like IMS, are seen as significant strategic challenges. They view it as a deliberate, often U.S.-backed effort to contain China's global economic influence and essentially compete with or disrupt their own Belt and Road network.
So IMS is seen as a direct competitor.
A direct competitor, potentially threatening China's access to key ports and markets across the Middle East and into Europe. And historically, Beijing often responds to what it perceives as these kinds of strategic provocations with actions in the gray zone military signaling that falls short of actual conflict. So the risk was that any strong rhetoric coming out of the Brussels forum or announcements of significant progress on IS could be interpreted by Beijing as warranting some kind of response. That means we have to watch closely for any potential uptick in PLA, People's Liberation Army, activity around Taiwan, more air incursions, maybe larger scale military drills.
Which would immediately hit.
Immediately hit global semiconductor stocks, given Taiwan's absolute dominance in advanced chip manufacturing, especially the giant, TSMC. It's a direct link.
Okay. We also need to touch on some of the domestic sector-specific disruptions happening in the U.S., particularly labor actions. That Boeing defense strike was dragging on, wasn't it? Entering week 9.
Yeah, a really major costly disruption for the whole aerospace and defense sector. It involves about 3,200 machinists striking primarily over wages and benefits, demanding pretty hefty increases, 20-24% over 4 or 5 years.
And talks weren't going well.
Federal mediation talks had completely failed by this point, and crucially, Boeing seemed to be hardening its stance. Reports indicated they were actively training permanent replacement workers and had even moved to terminate health insurance for the striking employees.
Ouch. So that directly impacts their defense, space and security division, military deliveries.
Absolutely. Delays critical military aircraft deliveries impacts the whole supply chain that feeds into Boeing's defense side. It's a significant ongoing headwind for them and the sector.
Beyond aerospace, we also saw some regulatory rumblings related to employment practices, specifically around non-compete agreements.
That's right. The FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, hosted a key workshop focusing on potentially anti-competitive non-compete agreements. Now, the agency had previously dropped its appeal of a ruling that blocked a nationwide ban on non-competes, but this workshop was seen as a clear signal to companies. A signal that the FTC is still planning to pursue aggressive case-by-case enforcement against non-compete clauses they deem unfair or restrictive. This particularly impacts sectors like healthcare, where non-competes often tie up specialized nurses and doctors, and also certain high-tech fields, where companies use them extensively to try and retain key talent. The regulatory enforcement risk remains quite high, even without a blanket ban.
And finally, let's just circle back one more time to that core vulnerability amplified by the U.S. government shutdown. This is a systemic cyber risk.
Yeah, the vulnerability profile was definitely elevated because of that loss of institutional capacity we talked about earlier. CISA operating at reduced strength, and specifically that $27 million in annual federal funding being terminated for the MSISAC.
Remind us again, MSISAC helps the smaller guys, right? State and local governments.
Exactly. The ones who often lack the big budgets for sophisticated cyber defenses. Suddenly, they lose their primary federal support network for threat intelligence and response coordination right at the same time overall federal cyber monitoring capacity is diminished.
That sounds like a recipe for increased risk.
It really is. It magnifies the risk environment significantly, makes those local government jurisdictions, and by extension, the critical infrastructure they often oversee, much more vulnerable. It also, interestingly, creates big opportunities for commercial cybersecurity vendors to step in and try to fill that void left by the federal pullback. But the overall combination this week, the data darkness, the geopolitical tensions keeping potential targets active, and this diminished federal cyber defense capacity, it meant the underlying operating risk profile was just extremely high. #TagTagOutro.
Well, we have certainly navigated a week of I think the word is extreme, divergence. Just look at it. Global interest rates being shaped by central banks like the RBNZ actually cutting rates, signaling maybe inflation is easing there.
While simultaneously, the U.S. bond market was facing this critical multi-day high-yield stress test of investor demand right across the curve, from the three-year out to the 30-year.
And all of this playing out, while the price of oil, the fate of safe haven assets like gold, they remained complete hostages to those geopolitical decisions coming out of OPEC plus a year and, of course, the ongoing tragic conflicts in the Middle East and Eastern Europe.
I think the key insight from this week, especially given that U.S. data vacuum, wasn't just the policy divergence between central banks, which was clear, but that stark economic divergence revealed domestically here in the U.S.
Through those corporate earnings, right? Pepsi and Delta.
Exactly. Those results provided maybe the most tangible, non-official evidence we got all week of that K-shaped recovery. Investors got this really clear company-level picture of who seems to be thriving, the higher-end consumer, the traveler, and who is really struggling under the weight of inflation, the mass-market consumer. That forces a crucial conversation about the real health of the economy, kind of filling the void left by the missing federal data.
So looking ahead, what does this all mean? What's the single, maybe provocative thought you think our listeners should be mulling over as they look towards next week?
I think it comes down to that forced reliance we saw this week. The only major forward-looking U.S. data point we actually got was that University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey. So given the complete absence of reliable, official data on jobs, on agricultural supply, you have to ask, how much weight will the Federal Reserve and, by extension, the entire global bond market end up placing on the consumer's belief about future inflation rather than objective economic reality when they set the global rate path?
That reliance on subjective sentiment, that feels risky.
It creates a tremendous amplification risk, doesn't it? Especially for market volatility next week, when hopefully those big delayed inflation numbers, the CPI, the PPI, finally arrive. Will they validate those consumer expectations? Or will they completely destroy them? The potential for a big market reaction based on that sentiment versus reality gap feels incredibly high.
A fascinating and potentially very volatile setup, all stemming fundamentally from a lapse in government funding. An incredible week to unpack. Thank you for guiding us through this deep dive.
My pleasure. It was certainly a complex one.